I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Mario Armstrong is back. The technology expert associated for many years with WYPR and NPR is one of the busiest men in tech think and tech advice. We get an hour of Mario's time today to talk about Twitter's IPO, Blockbuster's bust, Google's mystery barge, the teen flight from Facebook, and the best ways to secure your smartphone in this hack-happy digital world. Speaking of hacking, we'll get Mario's perspective on all the privacy questions that have been raised since Edward Snowden's revelations about the National Security Agency. Also joining us, Sean Gallagher, like Mario, based in Baltimore and a veteran of the tech beat. Tech Tuesday on Midday with Mario Armstrong and Sean Gallagher after the news. Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Midday on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, WYPO Ocean City, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. Dan Rodericks here. Thanking you again for making Midday part of your day. Nowadays, it seems like everyone is on Facebook, from coworkers to parents to grandparents, and it's partly because of this trend that's been driving teenagers away from the site and onto messaging apps. In what was described as a landmark admission, Facebook announced this month that it was seeing a decrease in its daily users, specifically teenagers. It seems teens don't find it so cool anymore that their elders are reading their posts and commenting on them. We'll be talking about this story with Mario Armstrong today, digital lifestyle expert and an award-winning tech thinker and commentator for NPR and NBC, well known to our listeners here at WYPR. A busy man, but joins us on Midday every once in a while to give us update on what's happening in the tech world. Mario, it's great to see you
again.
Good
to see you too, man.
You are the busiest man in showbiz, so thanks for stopping by today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
And I want to thank you for introducing us to our other guest today, Sean Gallagher, senior editor for the Condé Nast technology site Ars Technica. Sean, who lives right here in Baltimore, is the senior editor, the IT editor for Ars Technica, and I've been looking at that website, Sean. It's very busy, very rich, full of great stories and information. So thank you for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me.
How long have you been with Ars Technica?
For about 2 years now.
Yeah. What were you doing before that? Have you always been in the sort of tech review lab, as you put it?
Well, I've been in the technology journalism business for about 20 years.
On the beat for two decades. Nice to have you with us here. We got a lot of things to cover, guys. A busy show today. 410-662-8780 is the phone number if anyone has any questions about the topics that we'll be covering here. Everything from the Twitter IPO to the mysterious Google store or the Google barge out in San Francisco, the final demise of Blockbuster, and hacking and telephone safety or telephone security. Mario's got some advice on how to make your smartphone secure. But let's start with something I'm eager to ask you about is healthcare.gov. We don't want to spend a lot of time on this today because we could spend a lot of time on this today.
Absolutely.
But gee whiz, a mess described as a debacle by the Secretary of Health. And so my first time to hear from you, Mario, and you, Sean, on this. What are your observations about it? Sean, you want to share your thoughts on healthcare.gov?
Sure. So healthcare.gov started off poorly to begin with, and it just got worse as it went along. The part of the problem with the site is that the requirements kept changing for what they wanted from the site from the day they started. The requirements weren't really set in stone for almost a year after they passed the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. and then they kept changing what they wanted as they went along. So there were changes being made to the site up until a week before the site went live, and they never had an opportunity to test the site end-to-end to see if it worked properly.
So too many changes, too many demands asked too close to the deadline.
Right.
And a determination, obviously, Mario, to stick with that October 1st rollout.
Yeah, and that really, you know, probably if they could do something over again other than, you know, making the requirements constantly shift, they would certainly push back that deadline. Someone obviously thought they were still going to be able to make this work. But, you know, the thing is, I've had actual background experience. I used to work for Maryland Department of Tourism, and I remember what it was like to have the opportunity to want to make our call center very highly technical and be able to take those calls that would come in from ads that would be seen across the country about 1-800-VISIT-MARYLAND. And so you had to have databases and systems and technology that would be ready to handle that type of traffic and that type of volume. And I can say from experience, if you don't have those requirements down really cold prior to implementing anything, then you're constantly chasing the last bit of code you just typed up. And it really becomes almost a complete maze as to how you're going to fix any problems that then arise. Mm-hmm. And it just really compounds itself. And so, you know, it's unfortunate that it happened. I think people could say all day long about, oh, that just shows the amount of demand that the site was going to get.
We're past that excuse.
We're way past that one.
But it's a sort of political decision you had to make. The president had to make. Someone had to make was, do you go live knowing that may not be ready because they were told it may not be ready? There were warnings. Or do you go? Do you say we have to delay this 2 months or 3 months? And what would have been worse, I guess, in terms of the criticism, the public reaction?
I think that if they delayed it, it would have gotten some criticism, especially considering how much pressure they've been under from the Republican Party on
right.
the whole act as it is.
Right.
But
that was in the midst of a government right. shutdown, too,
but,
remember?
But the That's thing true. Is that they set themselves up to fail with this for a number of reasons. And one of them is just this is such a hyper-complex task to complete with the amount of time they had to do it. There are so many different moving parts that had to be hooked together. Mm-hmm. The information hub that connected all the health insurance companies into the system and all the states into the system.
Right.
There were pieces of it that weren't even working when they were launching the site. For example, the Veterans Administration's systems were not connected into it. So they couldn't determine whether people who were veterans could get a tax benefit, one of those tax premiums to help pay for their insurance based on their veteran status, because they couldn't hook into the VA systems to find out.
It was 3 years since the passage of that bill. You think they could have worked all this out in 3 years?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know about you, Mario. I'll get a lot done in 3 years.
Yeah,
give me 3 years.
Are you kidding me?
Let's move on
and
to this.
Technology. That's yes. good. Dog years.
That's a long time, right? Okay, let's move on to another one. The Twitter IPO. Twitter launched its initial public offering. It was viewed by Wall Street analysts mostly as a much more successful launch than Facebook's IPO. After Facebook went public, the company's shares lost much of their value. But, you know, this is a different thing. It happened on the New York Stock Exchange. There's lots of reasons to believe that this will work out better. Mario, what's your take on Twitter going public like this? And will it last? What's the deal?
I actually do think that all of the hype is pretty well supported. To an extent, I do believe that Twitter, because here's the reason why I say that. Number one, Twitter has not hit its full market potential by no means. And when you look at something like Facebook, they were really pretty well saturated by the time that they launched their IPO. So there wasn't too much room to really grow, although they had their mobile opportunities and things of that nature. With Twitter, there's a lot of room to still grow. And a lot of people are just joining Twitter and starting to use it. They do have a better way of getting advertising through their channel that I think will actually generate revenue for them.
Could you talk about that a little bit? Because that's not obvious to me.
Well, I mean, you're gonna start seeing more of it, probably more obvious than it's been.
Well, maybe
before.
That's why it hasn't been obvious.
You'll start seeing more of these paid tweets and paid promotions coming into your Twitter feed. I think they're going about it very delicately though, because they know that if that gets the wrong backlash, that's really going to hurt their main primary revenue opportunity, and then that's really going to tank the stock. And now that they're public, they can't really have the luxury of making those quick mistakes. They have to really strategically think through things even more so. So you'll start seeing more ads happening, but I think it's going to be trickled in, and you're going to start seeing companies be a little bit more responsible about how they use Twitter to actually advertise.
Is that how you see it, Sean?
Yeah, I think Twitter has the advantage of having been built for mobile from day one. I mean,
That's
the reason that Twitter has that 140 character limit is because it was originally designed to work with SMS messaging,
mm-hmm.
right, with smartphones. And the other piece of it is that companies are already using Twitter to interact with their customers in a big way. They use it as a help desk for dealing with customer complaints. Comcast has an intelligent agent that sits on Twitter and watches for people complaining about Comcast and routes that to customer service people to try and deal with people's complaints before they go viral.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting what Mario was saying about advertising. Now, if you're already following some entity, a restaurant, say, for instance, a pizza joint, and they're sending out notes about specials, that's not offensive. I think it would be the ones that come in unsolicited from entities that you're not following.
Yeah.
So they have to be careful right. there.
Yeah. And that'll happen.
Yeah. They've been experimenting with sponsored tweets for a right. while, things mm-hmm. that get inserted into your feed for a while. But that's going to start escalating, and they're going to find new ways to do that. Originally, they were having a hard time getting commercial messages into the stream. Celebrities were getting paid to
getting
do
paid
tweets
to do
about
them.
People.
That's right.
So
that's right.
they've taken that out of the loop now, and they're starting to introduce this way for people to do sponsored tweets that get injected into your feed. I see more and more of them every day.
And interjecting video now. You know, I mean, right. having video and photos. I mean, photos are always kind of there, but, you know, really having it more controlled within just the Twitter stream. You're not using a bunch of third-party things to really – you can pull up your Twitter app. You can look at it. You can see video clips playing. That's a whole new area for them to start to explore.
They're not thinking about charging a subscription, are they?
Not
that,
that,
that would be no. a big mistake.
No. They will lose
it
a
has
tremendous
to be free.
Amount of followers.
It has to be free in order for people to use it.
Has to be.
But I always wonder about this. When you get people hooked on something, they really
yeah.
like it.
Yeah.
And then you say, you know, we're going to charge you a few pennies each time you use it. Is that offensive to people? You know, if they can really hook them.
I think the nature of Twitter, people use it because it's free.
Yeah.
And also because they have an international audience, it's difficult to charge for something for an international audience in a way that's going to be effective.
I think what that would involve, credit cards and all that stuff all
right.
over the place,
yeah,
PayPal.
And if you consider how important Twitter was to things like this, the uprising in Egypt a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
and some of the other things that have been going on over around the world in terms of getting word out to the world about protests and things like that, Twitter's become almost too big to fail from the standpoint of the global conversation.
Right.
In fact, the U.S. government tried to push Twitter to put on more capacity to help keep up with the demand from some of those protests overseas to help
absolutely.
The word get out. So I think that putting a pay firewall on it, putting a paywall on it is going to be a big no.
Yeah. Thank you.
And another,
I'm glad to hear that. No fees for using Twitter.
No, and you bring up the news thing, and it's really, really big in that sense. And in fact, they just hired Vivian Schiller. Do you know Vivian
from
Schiller?
NPR?
From NPR, who was over at NBC running their digital. And they just hired her. I think she starts in January for heading up the news division of Twitter. So lots of significant changes are formulating, taking place. They're going to be okay.
Speaking of fees and that word change, we get to the Blockbuster story. This is the once mighty video rental chain that's now out of business. It closed the last of its 300 company-owned stores. Fees, late fees, that's what I associate with Blockbuster, even though they stopped it at some point.
They did stop
and
it
also
at some
that,
point, but it still felt painful.
It did. And also that word change. Now, here's a company that had an opportunity many years ago now. We're talking about probably the late 90s. When it was apparent that the internet was going to be the way to go with videos or DVDs with movies on demand or programming on demand, right? Yeah. And they never got around to that. They had a chance to reinvent themselves, Mario.
I have no idea how they missed this opportunity. It was smack dead in the face. And it's really, it's interesting. I think a lot of times when you look at CEOs or you look at companies and they don't make good decisions, at some point or another, I find a lot of times ego gets in the way. And in this case, I really do think that Blockbuster's own ego was in its own way. They actually thought that people were still going to want to leave the house, get into the car in the cold of winter, and go and pick up a DVD and then drive that back, you know, drive that back home. And, you know, it reminds me of a lot of other industries that were very ignorant to the power of the internet and very egotistical about how they can stay and hang in there. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking dead at you because you know some of the industries.
I think you have one particular industry
right.
that sort of missed the train early on.
Yeah.
Didn't see it coming.
Blockbuster had a lot invested in its stores. And it saw that as its gateway to people. And it was an old retail mentality.
Right.
And now that Dish bought them, and Dish saw them as a brand they could turn into a digital brand, the stores were dead weight. And so it's not really a big surprise they shed them.
Speaking of store, can we go to the Google Store story? I just call it a Google Store.
Right.
We're going to leave Blockbuster now because I won't particularly miss a Blockbuster. They kind of missed the internet train, as Mario said. But the Google Store. If you're not hip to this story, the San Francisco Chronicle is reporting that this big barge in San Francisco Bay, right, that is suspected to be a gigantic Google store? Is it, and it's going to set sail? And,
yeah, first they were saying it was going to be a floating data center. Okay. And right. Now they're saying it's going to be a floating display operation. So they're going to be able to move
Who's
it around.
Who's saying that? Is Google various, saying anything?
Google said nothing.
Yeah.
Google has said
yeah, they're
nothing.
They're on record with
there
nothing.
Was a lot of speculation initially because Google had filed a patent for an at sea data center where that used ocean cooling and power generated by tides to power the data center. But it's clear that that's not what this is at this point. The San Francisco Chronicle has reported that it's been revealed to be a display space, a portable display space to show off
for Google.
Google's products,
yeah.
Right.
To show off their products.
Yeah, and they have a lot of products now to show
I've
off.
I've heard they're working on products all the time now,
yeah,
right?
I mean, you look at their Nexus line of tablets and smartphones, which have done phenomenally well. I really like the new Nexus that's out. You look at the new device I brought in today for you, the Chromecast device,
right.
Which plugs right into the HDMI port in the back of any HD television that's out now, and that will enable me to connect that device that plugs right into the back of my TV to connect to my home network, and then I can push content from my mobile devices, not all content, but a good amount of content from my mobile device to that device so I can watch it on the big screen. So I don't have to watch YouTube.
I don't
surf
need a
the
cable.
Web.
You don't need a cable.
Yeah, I don't need a cord or any of that stuff. No, I mean, an Apple TV is done, you know.
This thing is about 2.5 inches long.
Right.
And it looks like a hotspot type of thing.
It's very small. It looks like something that can hang on your keychain.
Yeah.
Looks like, an oversized car key. But here's the kicker.
And this is
$35.
$35. This is a Google product.
Right.
That's right.
Wow. So they sell you this for $35, and they're hoping that you, what?
What
else with it?
Well, they'll hope that you'll watch more YouTube content, number one, because they get paid for that as well. But then they hope that you will start to use your television as a main hub for your computing. So instead of just being on your small tablet or being in the bed on your laptop, you'll get easier ways for you to get content from these handheld devices to the big screen.
What else is Google
have? When they first released that, they offered this deal to get free Netflix with it.
They
had to cut that off because it was so popular.
You're right.
It works great with Netflix, and it works great with laptops or tablets. It's also part of sort of pulling everybody into the Google ecosystem because they're trying to promote their social network, Google+. They're trying to get everybody to use all of the other Google products.
And the web browser.
Chrome browser.
Chrome. That's right.
And they're going to need room on the showroom floor for the Google car, right? Is there
gonna,
a Google car
they're
coming?
They're going to need room for that. Right. They don't need a lot of room for a Google Glass.
No.
But they'll need
so
some room
for
that.
So that's what that big thing is, supposedly, in San Francisco Bay.
It's supposed to be a showroom. That's what that's what the speculation is at this point.
It's not out of tune speculation. I mean, you see what Microsoft has done with their stores. You've seen Apple do their stores. I mean, you see a lot of these companies. You can go back to when Gateway. I remember when Gateway, the company, actually had its stores. Like, it's not out of the realm for companies now. You know, they're looking for, you go into a Best Buy, you see spaces. You see a Samsung space, an Apple space, a Microsoft space. Like, it's really carved out that they're trying to figure out how do they get that physical presence without really killing the profits.
Right. And then they've got so many products now, including the Chromebook.
That's right.
Other things like that they have a product line that essentially
laptop.
Parallels what Apple does now between
how much is it, Mario?
Like $279.
Yeah.
It's
all runs in the cloud. So
we unfortunately have to take a break. I don't even want to take a break talking to you guys, but I need to ask a quick question before this break. All right.
Okay.
So you mentioned Google and Netflix, and of course we mentioned the passing of Blockbuster. It made me think of this question about Amazon Platinum. Amazon offering all these free videos online with the Platinum. What's the deal with that? Am I paying more for Platinum? Am I paying anything to belong to this?
They're trying to create a subscription service, and they're trying to get themselves into the same business as Netflix. Follow that model. They're sponsoring their own. They've got their own content going on now. They're making their own shows, and just as Netflix is.
People don't know this. Like,
I didn't
Amazon
know Amazon
has
was.
Studios.
I didn't know that. I know Netflix is. They're making
Amazon's
one right here in
comedy with John Goodman as a senator.
Really?
Yeah. It's they're putting a lot of money into this business of creating content because they saw the Netflix model with House of Cards, filmed here in Baltimore, and some of the other things that Netflix has done, and they realized that this was an opportunity for them to become their own content factory using Amazon's existing infrastructure and tether people more tightly to Amazon, because then they know what you like when you watch it on television, then they can tell you to what you would like to buy.
Battle of the ecosystems.
Yes, battle of the ecosystems. And the egos, maybe, too. All right, we'll take a little break here with Sean Gallagher and Mario Armstrong. You're welcome to ask a question about anything that we're discussing on the show today. 410-662-8780. Toll-free, long distance for the Midday Show in WYPR Baltimore is 866-661-9309. Send us a question by email, midday@wypr.org.
Called Quantum.
I wanted to talk for a moment about the NSA hacking scandal that's been leaked in spurts by former government contractor Edward Snowden. There was another one out yesterday, I think. Dan Roderick's here with Mario Armstrong and Sean Gallagher. And Sean, talk a little bit. You have a new post on Ars Technica about this.
Right. So there is an attack that the GCHQ, the British equivalent of the NSA, and the NSA have been using called a quantum insert. And what it does is it allows those agencies to redirect the traffic of an individual or a company through the internet to a server they've set up to mimic another site and allows them to do what's called a man-in-the-middle attack. So, for example, say you wanted to go to Google and NSA wanted to get to you. They would go to your ISP or go to AT&T or someone. They don't do this domestically, but let's just say theoretically. They would go and change the internet routing tables for your internet address so that when you requested to go to Google, you'd be redirected through what they call a static route to a server they set up that was a front end for Google. And so your credentials, when you logged into your Google account, would get passed to them. You'd think you were on the Google site. You'd be getting content from the Google site. But at the same time, they could be passing down a virus to your computer that would allow them to take over your computer, get into the back, insert back doors to get to information on your computer, get to the rest of your network.
So Snowden has reported that this method was being used?
Yes, it was used to hack OPEC and give information about oil sales to NSA to pass to the Energy Department. It was also used by GCHQ to do the same thing. It was also used by GCHQ to hack a Belgian telecommunications company to learn more about the internals of that company. They hacked an engineer and were able to get his credentials, get information about him. And they had this program called Operation Socialist, which was like, as in social networking. They set up a fake website that looked like LinkedIn and like Slashdot specifically for this user, so that when he went to these sites and he logged in, they got his credentials for LinkedIn, they got his Slashdot credentials, and were able to send information back down to his computer.
Now, we all know about Snowden from his revelations about the NSA surveillance, or actually NSA capture of megadata, right? All the telephone calls every American makes in the history of the telephone. But this is new. So this information is being released, as I said, in spurts. Is that accurate?
Right. He's releasing it in chunks. Actually, he's actually given all the information to a couple of reporters.
The Guardian,
The Washington Post, and Der Spiegel. Der Spiegel has been releasing a bunch of this recently.
So this is highly specific about how they went about this.
He's got slides from PowerPoint presentations that were given on these things that he pulled off of the NSA's network. The thing is that he was an administrator at a small NSA post in Hawaii.
Right.
And he was able to obtain the passwords of about 20 to 30 coworkers to get into the NSA's intranet, their internal secret network where they keep all of these documents that they share with each other on presentations they gave. And he was able to download all of them and take them off with him. And they had been working on installing anti-insider threat software across the NSA because of WikiLeaks. But the Hawaii base where he was never got the software installed because they didn't have enough of a network connection to be able to pull everything across from the mainland to Hawaii.
To pull all the security across.
Right.
Right. But by the way, Sean, the other suggestion that the NSA might have hacked telephones, cell phones including of some heads of state, is that, are we finding out that to be accurate, and was the same method, type of method used?
Well, they're able to target the smartphones from the standpoint of the data that goes in and out of them, but they also do radio communications monitoring that allows them to intercept signals, and they have the ability to unencrypt certain types of signals. So up until a certain point a few years ago, Angela Merkel's cell phone was tapped, essentially, because she was using a personal phone that didn't have security on it.
Mm-hmm.
She switched to another phone that had encryption on it. It's not known whether they were still monitoring her phone or not, but it's pretty clear that they were able to get a lot of information from her phone calls for a number of years prior to her picking up an encrypted phone. She now has a BlackBerry that has special encryption on it and another phone that has encryption on it that allows her voice to be encrypted as it travels over the airwaves.
Sean Gallagher is senior editor for the Condé Nast technology site Ars Technica. Mario Armstrong, award-winning commentator on all things tech, with us again today on Midday. So that brings us to another thing we wanted to talk about. Smartphone security, not just for heads of state, but for the rest
heads
of us,
households.
For all of us.
Right.
Yeah. So, Mario, I'm interested in what you have to say about this, and I posted a video of yours about this system called Master Lock that you can talk about in a minute. I just wanted to quote here, TechCrunch Disrupt Conference was held in September, the TechCrunch Disrupt Conference. I don't know what that is, actually. I think a bunch of Silicon Valley movers and shakers get together to talk about this. Google's top security executive was there, Heather Adkins, and she declared passwords dead. And that's, from a company that has 425 million email accounts.
Right.
Passwords are dead. Passwords are passé.
Yeah.
Passwords are annoying. They're an inconvenience, but they're also not very safe. What do you think?
I think that's pretty accurate. I think that's I think it's interesting that it's coming from a company that you log into your Gmail account, you have to have a password. But this is also why you've seen a lot of companies doing things like two-step authentication, where you have to not only plug in a password, but then you also get like an authorization code sent to your mobile device, and then you plug that code in, and that's kind of like this two-step authentication. So there are a lot of different companies looking to find a solution to this password issue, because the bottom line is we have password accounts for our shopping, for the stuff that we log into, for our ATM machines, for our voicemails, for all of these things, and it's becoming too much. So either you resolve to the fact of downloading a piece of software like a password manager that is a piece of software that can hold all of your passwords securely that you can have access to with a master password. But here's the thing. All of that still doesn't matter if the password is weak. If we as individuals don't understand how to make complicated passwords, anything that can be found in a dictionary is immediately hackable. So it's always been advised to use, and I've always tried to use more than 8, but the minimum should be 8 characters, and it should be a combination of upper and lower case and symbols and numbers, and it should mean something to you. So a lot of times people will try to spell out phrases with their passwords using different symbols to mean the beginning letter of a word in a sentence.
Even if you come up with a phrase, as you've described it, which is probably the high end of security at this point for passwords, I bet you there are people listening now who use the same password for almost all their accounts.
There you go. And so you could have a great phrase.
So they figure it's safe. Right. So why not use it for all my accounts?
You're only as good as your weakest link. And a lot of people forget this too, that even if, say, your email is something that you don't really pass back and forth a lot of sensitive information. So maybe you don't make that email password as secure as your online banking password is. The bottom line is, if I can get into your email account, I can be pretty genius and pretty stealth about being able to pull other information that'll eventually get me around to getting more information that I need about you or some identity theft that I want to take out on you.
What did you like about Master Lock?
I just think, it's just another app. I don't know if it's not the holy grail. I mean, there's another one out there called Dashlane that's been getting a lot of attention as well lately. I just feel like if you are going to use a company and you are going to store secure documents or passwords and information with it, it should be a company that has a lot to lose. I'm a big fan of startups, but I'm also skeptical to an extent when we have to deal with startups for very sensitive information.
Sean, where are you on passwords?
Well, we've done a lot of reporting about bad passwords, weak passwords at Ars Technica. And the big problem is, no matter how secure your passwords are for your different accounts, if your endpoint isn't secure, your you're in trouble.
What do you mean?
Meaning your phone, your computer. So, for example, if you've got all these different passwords that you've got for different services and you've got them stored on your phone, if somebody just gets a hold of your phone,
I get you. That's why we're in trouble. That's why we're talking about this.
Right. So,
what do you recommend for smart? First of all, just as a general practice for people, should they lock their phones?
You should lock your phone.
Absolutely.
How often
Absolutely.
Should you lock your phone?
You should lock your phone. I have my phone locked within 5 minutes of me not using it.
And I think that's too long for me. Know. Maybe.
But that's because it's permanently grafted to my head, right? So,
see, I don't trust myself.
And
I'm in coffee shops.
Do not use the default 4-digit PIN password to get in your phone. You can use a much more complex password to lock your phone than a 4-digit PIN on the iPhone or on Android.
Yep. Go into your settings, people. You can absolutely do not. The 4-digit PIN is a really solid point. People don't want to do it, though, because they feel like it's a lot of work. But
well, yeah, and the 4-digit PIN is so easy to hack.
You open your settings up and you reset your PIN, right?
That's right.
Right.
How hard is that?
You basically turn off something that's called simple passcode. So once you go into the settings and you'll see it in there, it'll say simple passcode. And by default, simple passcode is already on. And that's the 4-digit. Right. If you turn that off, it'll open up to an alphanumeric entry form where you can put in letters, numbers, symbols, all kinds of things.
And you can make that as long as you want it to be.
Correct.
It just is within practice. It gets impractical at a certain point to have a 24-digit password to log in your phone every time it turns off every 5 minutes.
Right.
So there's a balance to that, right?
Okay. But for folks who are listening here, they think, well, I don't work for the NSA. I don't work for the federal government. I'm not a busy tech guy like Mario and Sean are. What do I need this for, really?
Well, if you use your phone to do any banking or use your phone to get on the web for anything else with any other applications that have personal information in them, if you leave your phone not secure and someone picks it up while you're in a food court at a mall or something like that, and they're able to get into it and keep it live without it being locked.
For even a few minutes.
For even a few minutes, they can get access to all your information. And there's also the possibility of somebody taking your phone and then changing the password and then syncing it with their computer and pulling all the data off of it.
Okay.
And that's like on one end of the spectrum. You could just have someone that's just, look, here's the thing. We have so many memories, I'm talking personal. I'm not even talking about like identity theft stuff. I'm talking videos, photos, text messages, things that we just really have over time that we forget that's really in this digital device. And so a lot of people ask someone if they lose their phone and lose their photos and videos, how much pain do they really kind of go through?
Or if somebody gets access to the wrong picture. So, for example, there's a bill in the Maryland House right now on revenge porn.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you leave your device unsecure, somebody you trust could take something off of your phone that you don't want on the internet and get it on the internet.
Yep, easily.
And there have been other cases where, you know, we've talked about the phone hacking that reporters were doing in the UK just by hacking into the voicemail of phone systems. And that happens to people all the time. You can get somebody access to somebody's voicemail just by sitting there hitting 4-digit combinations all day long until you break in.
A question by email from one of our listeners, Jeff, on this subject. What about lockouts after 3 or 5 bad attempts? Do hackers have a workaround for that problem? Occasionally, I'll get a message from my credit card company that I had 5 failed attempts and have to change my password. Of course, I hadn't actually tried to log on.
There are ways with phones to set it so that if there are a certain number of bad attempts, that it wipes the phone. So that's one option.
That is an option.
It wipes.
It just wipes personal information off the phone completely.
Clean.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an app you need to get.
That's actually part of iOS.
It's built in iOS.
It's built in iOS.
Is it really? Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. We're going to take another break here. We'll come back for more questions for Mario Armstrong and Sean Gallagher from Ars Technica. We're going to talk about Facebook and teenagers coming up. And fake reviews. This is interesting. Yelp, fake reviews on Amazon and Yelp. If you have questions for our guests, 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. From Killer Kowalski to Andre the Giant, Hulk Hogan and Macho Man Randy Savage. The second hour of today's Midday offers a history of the circus-like world of professional wrestling. David Shoemaker of Grantland and Deadspin offers true tales from the fake world of wrestling after the news at 1. And welcome back. It's Tech Tuesday on Midday. Mario Armstrong with us and Sean Gallagher joining us. Sean is based here in Baltimore, lives here. He serves as senior editor for Ars Technica. You can find a link to Ars Technica. It's a very rich website, lots of information and tech news on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. And speaking of Facebook, our next subject has to do something we've talked about before, Mario, is that teenagers moving away from Facebook, finding it not so cool because adults had moved in.
Yeah.
Right?
And absolutely.
This is kind of, in some ways, an old story, but apparently the flight from Facebook has picked up among teenagers. Although, this is my sense of it, teens and young adults, kids who grew up with Facebook now, because it's been around for a while, they keep it sort of as an obligatory communications tool, something you check in on from time to time, wish somebody happy birthday, but they don't find it to be as much fun anymore.
No,
absolutely. And so they moved other places to certain kinds of apps for their fun. Is that my impression?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've moved more towards these almost like text messaging type of apps where it's really not about, you know, Facebook was all initially about logging into your computer and being on a browser before it was even really something you did on your mobile device. They're growing up with mobile devices in their hands, so they're more apt to use apps that are made on mobile devices. So they're using things like Snapchat and WeChat and other messenger type apps that a lot of parents don't know about and have no need to use because they don't have a community that's using those apps.
Right. Here are three that are mentioned that you didn't mention that were on an NPR story recently, Mario. One is WhatsApp.
Yep.
WeChat, and is it Kakao Talk? K-A-K-A-O Talk.
Kakao Talk.
Kakao Talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where the fun is.
And that's just that's just three.
Things like Instagram.
Yeah,
I have a daughter who's 12, and she's on Instagram, and she's got a community of friends. She talks through Instagram, and I've had to shut down on the chat conversations.
Good
just
for
to
you.
Make sure that she's not entering a realm where I don't have.
I was
control
just,
over who she's no, talking
I was just going to ask you about that. So
I'm not. You know, here's the thing. It's like it's an individual parental decision on how you parent your kids, right? So it's all about whether or not you know your level of your kids' maturity. But what I just don't have a stomach, me personally speaking, are for parents that are buckling under pressure because they're getting it from other kids that are saying, they have a phone and they have an Instagram account. Look, bottom line on this stuff, you're really not supposed to be on it until the age of 13 for a reason.
Right.
I mean, you really aren't. I mean, technically, right? But with someone like Sean, you know, it's like, I know he knows how to lock it down. I know he knows what things to look for. I know he knows probably, you know, how to teach. And that's your parenting decision.
My kids
know
I can hack their system.
Right.
So they're well aware of the fact that if I need to monitor them, I can monitor
them. You old hacker, you, Sean Gallagher.
My kid doesn't have it.
You say not until 13. Is that you mean legally? Do you mean these apps have a declaration or some kind?
That's the terms of service.
Terms of service.
Child Online Privacy Protection Act states that you're not supposed to be on these types of systems until the age of 13. Okay. You're supposed to validate your age. Of course, there's really no way of validating, so kids jump on the latest, hottest thing.
Right.
Right.
So,
I mean, they don't. There's no way to check whether you're 12 years old or 13 years
old
when you go on to use an application. It's your word. You got an email. If you've got an email account, you've got an account.
Right.
But Mario, so what's your recommendation to parents? Your parents ask about this. Say, I got an 11-year-old. She's been using Pinterest or Instagram. I don't really know what's going on there. Every once in a while, she shows me a recipe for cookies or something like that.
Right.
But there might be some other stuff going on.
Yeah.
So what do you say
to
parents?
I think there are a couple of ways that you can approach this. I think, number one, the key is communication in the household. But I think if you're not having that great dialogue already, then you may need some tools to kind of help prod this conversation. I think having an internet bill of rights, there are plenty of them that you can download off the internet. Just do a search for parenting bill of rights or internet bill of rights and find one that's out there that really you and your children can go through line by line and sign off on. At least make them more conscious about the fact that they're entering into an agreement with their parent. And then it's not this fist fight between mom just doesn't understand. It's more of, well, let's, you know, we're doing a contract here. We're having a discussion. I'm giving you some leeway.
What do you think of that idea?
I think that having a contract or at least some sort of an agreement is important.
Huh.
And I think it's just a vehicle to have a conversation with your kids about it.
Right.
Because they have this one picture of who is out there on the internet or who is using these apps on mobile devices, and you've got a totally different picture in your mind if you've been paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the things that I cover on a daily basis, I'm hyper-paranoid about what's going on the internet, and I have a certain level of expectation about what I click on, what I visit on the web, what I respond to in Facebook or any of these other applications. Mm-hmm. And my kids don't have that experience. They don't understand what the threats are. And it's important to have a conversation about what can happen online, what has happened online, and not necessarily to scare them, but to let them understand that there's a certain level of responsibility and a certain amount of, you know, they have to take everything that's online with a grain of salt and have a certain amount of suspicion initially about who they're dealing with online until they have a way of...
This is a huge education issue, too. I think schools should be adopting something that's really helping our kids become smarter about being digital decision makers. The bottom line is this is what they're growing up with. This is the world they're in. So is that Wikipedia page a legitimate source? Or how do I know to look up other information to find legitimate info that I'm trying to research on something? How do I really make responsible decisions in a digital age versus an analog age where many of us grew up in? So I think we need to take it a lot more serious than here's a new app we have to fight against. You know, here's a new thing that came up. There's going to be constantly new things. It's all about educating and exposing our kids and giving our parents some tools to be able to have that dialogue.
Thank you, Mario. Mario and Sean Gallagher, our guests in this hour. I did something I haven't done before, was write a review of a restaurant on Yelp recently.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because I was so upset about this restaurant.
Oh, so no good reviews come from Dan, no. Only bad reviews.
And I know people go on there to give good reviews, but I also wonder, you know, maybe the owner's son and daughter give good reviews. But apparently there are fake reviews on Yelp and Amazon, too, for products, I guess.
There are.
What's
there
going
are.
On here, Sean?
So it's called astroturfing. So it's fake grassroots support.
So, I gotta love that
term. So yeah. What happens is people have to manage their – they feel they need to manage their reputation online. Yeah. And so they either on their own go and post positive reviews or they have friends post positive reviews. And this can really distort the picture that people have of what's online or what these businesses are. And there are even people who sort of aggressively go after people who say negative things about them online. There's this bus company in Illinois called Suburban Express where the owner has been accused of stalking people who posted bad reviews.
Oh, no.
And in fact, he's banned people who've given bad reviews for life from riding on
from
his buses.
From riding on right. his buses. Oh, wow.
So, and there's a whole other storm around that particular company in terms of how he deals with sites like Reddit and things that he's engaged with people on online to try and protect his business, but at the same time, he's creating what's called the Streisand effect by trying to squelch this other commentary. Yep. A while back, Barbara Streisand tried to squelch some commentary online about something about her legally, and it created this bigger storm.
Blew up even bigger. Mm-hmm. Right.
So what he's doing is he's creating that around his business.
Yeah. What are you supposed to do about this? What can be done about it? What's an authentic review and what isn't? How do you sort that out?
Just eat at the restaurant you've always eaten at before.
Don't try anything new.
Just keep life simple, folks.
You got to read these things with a certain amount of cynicism. You have to read it and look at it and say, does this sound like somebody actually did this?
It gets rough, though, because you start planning your trips and vacations and all these things, and you really want to know, is that hotel really, are these reviews really legitimate reviews? Are those photos the right photos? You know, and so when you look at when you do travel, a lot of people are spending a lot of money to go away or something like that, so they really take these reviews as something that's really meaningful to them, and maybe that's because they're really honest about how they would review something, and they don't expect someone to do the opposite.
You just can't trust a single source.
I don't tend to trust user reviews. I look for, like, a review of a restaurant. I look for a restaurant critic, someone who gets paid to do this, probably at a newspaper or a magazine. Travel, a magazine writer. That's a bias of mine toward the journalists who are still out there doing that kind of travel writing.
But maybe that's what that's more helpful to a lot of folks that are listening right now.
Hey, I got a bunch of questions
for days.
Excuse me, Mario. I got a bunch of questions here by email and on the phone for our guests. So let's try to get to them in the time remaining in this hour. First, we'll go to Ben, who's holding on the phone. Ben's in Forest Hill. You're on Midday. Hi.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about the data erase option that your guests were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious because I have a 2-year-old who knows perfectly well how to swipe and open my phone and just start punching buttons.
Right.
Is there a way to retrieve any lost data that he would otherwise inflict upon my phone.
Yeah. Do you have your phone set up to back up to the cloud or back up via iTunes?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So if you set up the backup for your phone to be on a more regular basis, you can have it back up to the cloud regularly. And then if the phone gets wiped, you can just restore from the web or restore from the cloud.
And it restores all data.
Yes.
All the data that you backed up. That's right.
Here's a question by email from Brian. Mario, any suggestions for a good app for locating or turning off your phone if stolen?
Well, it depends on the phone, but certainly you have Find iPhone is already built into iOS. Android has another app. I can't think of it right now. But if you do a search on Android Store for Find My Phone, you'll be able to find some apps that can absolutely do that. Yes.
Question about video streaming. I'd love to know if there was a way to combine services such as Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon or others to get all of my favorite programming so I can get rid of Xfinity. Certain programming, like National Geographic Channel, Discovery Channel, is not available on Netflix or Hulu. So how do I pull all that off? This is from Neil.
That's the million-dollar question, right?
Yeah, that's a lot.
This is why Xfinity is still in business.
Right.
There are certain things that you can't yet get by pulling the plug from cable.
Right.
We've got people on staff at ours who've gone totally streaming, are all internet, and they miss a large chunk of media. They know that they do, and they don't care.
They don't care.
And so if you want certain things, you need to weigh your options. I have a Roku box. I have an Apple TV box. And I have one of those Google Chrome devices. Anything that's available online, I can stream to any television set in my house. But there are still
the key thing is online.
Online, right. That's right.
Yeah,
so you know, unless you're willing to incur the wrath of the FBI and go find something on Pirate Bay to download episodes after they've been ripped the day before, then you're pretty much stuck with whatever's online, and you have to sort of play this game of searching the services.
Eventually, it'll all be there.
It's moving quicker.
Huh?
It's moving very quickly.
Kyle writes in to ask, what do your guests have to say about OpenID? It has mostly been co-opted and made half proprietary by Facebook, Google, Twitter, and more, but it offers the ability to manage your accounts in a centralized manner. There is no way for me to manage hundreds of accounts with unique and secure passwords. OpenID?
OpenID is a standard that Twitter and Google and Facebook have used to build this structure where if you log into a site and it says I can log in with your Facebook account.
My Facebook account, yeah.
That allows you to create accounts using your credentials with another site.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the equivalent of single sign-on for the web. It's based on your ability to use one of these other services. It's a good idea, but it's also only as secure as that particular login is.
Yep.
So if you feel comfortable with the security of that for some commentary on some other sites, identifying yourself for access to content and things like that, that's great. But I don't see OpenID as being viable for banking or anything that right now. So,
okay. One more question in this regard, password safety. I use AgileBits 1Password to store my passwords, and it works really well. I have a 20-character password or so that's truly random and doesn't mean anything. I've just committed it to memory. My question is, why do so many financial institutions not allow truly secure passwords? Google and Facebook will let me have ridiculously long passwords with any character except a space, but my student loan account limits me to 8 passwords or eight characters
it's
and no special
it's
characters.
It's your student loan account.
Yeah.
The problem is that everybody's got a different standard for how they handle passwords.
Yep.
And I've got one account where my username is a password, essentially, and my password is just some small string. My username is to be kept secret. And American Express does that.
Mm-hmm.
They have this. You have this long username that you have to keep secret, which is really your password.
Right.
And then a password, which is a much shorter thing. And then government sites have different password rules. I just had to do something with federal student aid for my son who goes to Towson. And it took 6 days for my PIN to be verified. And my PIN is only a 4-digit number. So, really, if somebody wanted to hack into FAFSA, they could just go and find my information, try and keep trying different 4-digit
combinations,
right?
And then
that's really secure, right?
Right.
But the problem is there have been too many different standards for how people do security, and it's got to be made more common.
Right.
Are we out of time?
Biometrics.
Oh, biometrics tells us we're out of time in this hour of the show, too.
Good.
Mario, nice to have you back with
us.
Good to see you. Mario Armstrong, good to see you. And thanks for introducing us to Sean Gallagher.
Absolutely.
Senior editor for Condé Nast's Ars Technica site. That's Ars Technica. Sean, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you for all these answers, guys. Let's do this again sometime, please.
That'll be good.
Sure.
We're going to take a break here for lunch, brought to Mario and Sean today by Bagby Pizza Company, located in Baltimore's historic Bagby Building in Harbor East. Pizza. Well, they got something better than pizza out there. I think they got some pasta, some salad. They do that. They do gourmet sandwiches. Anyway, it's open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with nightly delivery 5 to 9 p.m. Thanks to Bagby Pizza Company for providing lunch for our guests. Stay tuned for the news in the second hour of our show.